Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, a podcast that is dedicated towards bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. I truly appreciate you all taking this ride with me and with us as we look to do just that, and that is bridge that divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Please remember to follow me on Instagram, CPTL Hunter, Twitter, CPTL Hunter, Captain Hunter's Podcast on Facebook, Captain Hunter's Podcast on YouTube. I started uploading a bunch more videos. Hopefully going forward, any interviews that I do will also be recorded visually. And so therefore they will be placed up on YouTube as well. So make sure that you follow me on YouTube, Facebook, both of those are Captain Hunter's Podcast. You can support the podcast through Patreon page, Captain Hunter's Podcast on Patreon. You can support the podcast through PayPal, Cash App, Venmo. $1 or $2 an episode or whatever you can do in order to help support the podcast would greatly be appreciated. So we're getting right into the episode here. So for today, we're going to be looking at the importance of diversity in police departments and what it takes to achieve that diversity. And so I want to welcome my special guest, Captain Sonia Pruitt of the Montgomery County Police Department in Laurel, Maryland. Here's a little bit about Captain Pruitt's bio. Captain Sonia Pruitt began her law enforcement career as an officer with the Montgomery Police Department of Maryland. She served as Deputy Director of the Internal Affairs Division and was later promoted to Administrative Lieutenant for the Office of the Chief of Police, where she helped to oversee the department's budget and staff. She has worked as a call taker for 911 Dispatch Center, an investigative sergeant, and a supervisor of the School Resource Program. In 2019, Pruitt was promoted to captain. She currently serves as a deputy commander, supervising calls for service countywide. Pruitt is the past president of the Coalition of Black Police Officers in Montgomery, Maryland, and since 2018 has served as the chairperson of the National Black Police Association. She holds a BS in criminal justice from University of Maryland University College and an MA in forensic psychology from Argosy University. She is an adjunct professor of criminal justice administration at the Montgomery College and teaches courses including Introduction to Policing, Criminal Investigation, and Police Organization and Administration. She is also a member of Law Enforcement Action Partnership, otherwise known as LEAP, as well as myself. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to be discussing the importance of diversity within police departments. So I want to thank once again my special guest, Captain Sonia Pruitt, to Captain Hunter's Podcast. Here is the interview. All right. So once again, we're talking to Captain Sonia Pruitt. And thank you so much for being on Captain Hunter's Podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
You're a member of Law Enforcement Action Partnership, as am I. And so just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do for that organization and just yourself in general.
Okay. I call myself a transplant from North Carolina. I ended up in the Washington metropolitan area as a student at Howard University undergrad in 1981. So I've been here for a while, and I feel like I'm a member of the DMV, as we call it, the District, Maryland, and Virginia. I became a police officer after deciding that being a doctor was not for me. I knew I was not going to stay up all night long doing any kind of an internship or residency or anything like that. So then because I'm a science geek, I try to go into research. So I worked at the National Institutes of Health for a while. I don't like the repetitiveness of research. So I was like, this is, not for me. So I became a police officer because as I was working for the U.S. Postal Service Inspection Service, which is their law enforcement branch, I decided I wanted to go into law enforcement. So I became a police officer. I was like, yeah, I could be outside. I like being outside. I like being around people. This will be fun and exciting. I did not know what I was getting myself into, actually, but I was, ready for it. So that's how I became a police officer. I've been a police officer for 27 years. I am currently a captain in charge of community engagement for the Montgomery County Police Department. And I am also the chairwoman of the National Black Police Association. And I got my hat in various other and sundry rings of law enforcement and speaking and things like that.
Very good. Awesome. Awesome. My cousin currently works for the inspectional services. I'm hoping I'm saying that right, for the post office. He works
inspection service. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. He'd probably kill me. He tells me so many times, but he actually is located in Tampa, Florida. So he's got a fairly wide range of territories he's got to deal with as far as his responsibilities. He installs the security surveillance equipment, try to catch the postal workers, you know, stealing or.
Oh, bad. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's got some really cool gadgets and stuff. Yeah.
All right.
So I wanted to have you on because I had a previous conversation with another person, leader of a Black National Black Police Officers of Association of America. And so I wanted to have you on to talk about the importance of Black police officers. And, you know, we're having a problem right now with recruitment overall. Police officer people do not want to become police officers overall, but particularly it's problematic within the Black community. And I wanted to have you on just to kind of talk about that and what we can do to fix this problem. Are you seeing a problem with getting more young people or more people, particularly people of color, Black people, to become police officers?
I'm not sure whether that is an urban legend or not. But let me tell you why. So in my career, I have worked in background investigations. And we were having that same dialogue that, oh, it's so hard to find particularly Black people to become the police. But I contend that there are plenty of Black applicants out there. You just have to hire them. You cannot find excuses not to hire them because of your implicit biases or your overt biases. You cannot put them into you can't measure them by measurements that are not the same measurements that you measure all the other applicants by. Meaning, once they pass the basic parameters, you don't get to add extra parameters. For instance, and I'm going to use this as a true example. Once you pass the parameters, you can't then say, well, they have to have a bachelor's degree, which they have, but they didn't pass a class when they were an undergrad. there's no such parameter. They have a bachelor's degree, which is what the parameter is. Mm-hmm. So I have seen that happen and, you know, questioned that and, you know, I had to argue about it and that person was not hired. So I'm going to say that if you're not doing everything you can to diversify your police department in a fair and impartial way, then I'm going to throw out the window that argument that there are not enough Black applicants, not enough women applicants, not enough Latino applicants, whatever the category is. I'm going to say, unless you're doing it fairly and across the board, and then I'm going to also add, if you are going out of your way to bypass the parameters in order to get a certain type of applicant or a certain category, then you're still not playing fairly. Okay. So I am not clear, sir, captain, that is really an issue. I think, anecdotally, that it is an excuse, because what I see is, okay, the Black community, they have an issue with us. So we can always say that they don't want to become the police. I'm not convinced of that. When we had a Black captain who was the director of our personnel division, for instance, with my police department, we didn't seem to have that issue. Okay. And so one has to wonder what the issues really are.
Okay. That's a very fair point. I too, but I, here's my contention. And I too was a member of our background team and all that kind of stuff, recruitment team. And so I went to colleges, to schools, to barbershops, churches, et cetera, trying to get many applicants to sign up. And many, when you go to colleges, we were hitting, some universities here in, UConn, WestCon, Western Connecticut State University, and other schools around the state of Connecticut, and even in our home city. And the people that were taking the applications or showed some type of interest generally were white. And many Black applicants or potential Black applicants would tell us straight out that they weren't interested. Now, some did. I'm not saying that many didn't. But those who did show some interest, obviously, you know, they came on. The Chicago Tribune, a while ago, maybe I read this article maybe back in October or so, September, October. They did a really good article. I can send it to you if I can find it. And it was talking about this whole problem that they were having in Chicago with all the problems that the Chicago Police Department has, and they want more Black people to apply. And their head of their personnel division for the city, not just a police officer, but for the city, was talking about how come there were not enough Black applicants. And one of the things that the personnel director was talking about was similar to what you were just mentioning about going through with the selection process. Many people are being weeded out for silly things that others were not being weeded out as. On. And she was saying that the legacy groups, particularly Latino legacy groups, right? So we have you remember the National Black Police Officers Association, right? So their legacy groups, Latino legacy groups were actually staying with their applicants throughout the process, right? So they're helping them prepare for the physical, prepare for the written, prepare for the oral. Uh-huh. And that was a difference in why the Latino applicants were doing better on the test, whereas Black people, Black officers or Black applicants were taking a test, and then that was it. Next time you see them was for their physical portion, and they couldn't pass it. Well, one of the reasons is obviously because the groups were not doing enough to make sure that they passed it. So that was one of the critiques that the personnel director had seen.
You know, I like that idea of following the applicant. So when I first applied, my Black background, she was my recruiter, not the background investigator. My recruiter, I missed my first test. I just didn't show up. You know, I was being lazy. You know, that happens a lot with recruits, Black, white, brown, you know.
It does. It does. Right.
Because we are young and we're not dedicated yet. And you know, we're young. So she called me and she said, I'm going to need you to come to this test. And I said, yes, ma'am, and I showed up. So when I was in background, I remember having a conversation with one of the executives that was there at the time, and I said, hey, you know, I have this idea. Why don't we make sure that we follow up with our applicants since we're having a problem with diversity or a problem that somebody says we have. I'm not sure if we really have one. But anyway, why don't we call our applicants, you know, who seem not to want to come and take the test to make sure they come in and take the test? And she said, well, we can't do that. And I said, why not? She said, because that's against federal law. I said, well, can we see that so we can, you know, understand it? Where can we find that in the federal regs so that we can read it? And she never answered because there is no such thing. So I suggested then, because I got the impression that she was feeling some kind of way about calling Black applicants.
Okay.
I said, why don't we just call all the applicants? You know, we don't have to just call the Black applicants. We can call them all and make sure that, you know that they need to come and take the test because most of them are young and we, you know, probably need to give them a little nudge. Oh, no, that we can't do that. That's against the federal regs. I was like, okay. So it's stuff like that that keeps us from being able to hire qualified women and Black and Latino and Asian and so forth applicants. In my opinion, at least from my small vantage point, you know.
No, I take that and I accept that. I think that what you're saying is absolutely valid, and I'm not pushing back against that. I'm trying to add to it and say that it is a problem. We do need to give people a nudge, and I also have noticed where, as you mentioned, as you sat in your I would assume meetings, or whatever. And talked about, okay, why are we bouncing this person? Because when they were 14, they smoked weed. What are we talking about here? So why are we doing that? And we had the same conversations. Wait a minute. Okay, this guy got a ticket when he was 18. He's 33 now. What are you talking about? So sometimes I think that the rules, if not fairly across the board, can bounce people who could be potentially good applicants. I completely agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
So just tell us a little bit about the organization, the National Black Police Officers. Or tell us a little bit about them and what you do, and as you are the chairwoman, and what your responsibilities are.
So the National Black Police Association was, we originated in 1972. The need came about because black police officers from across the country were having issues being hired, and once being hired, they were having some problems being promoted, being placed in specialized units, not being represented by the Fraternal Order of Police. And guess what? This is 2019, and we still have the same issues, by the way.
Well, it's, so, 20, it's 2020, officers, 2020 now.
It's 2020. I'm behind a little bit.
It's all right.
And so they got together a group of 13 groups of officers from, when I say 13, I mean 13 cities, came together in St. Louis in 1972, had our first meeting and organized the National Black Police Association as a Maryland entity. And we've been rolling ever since. And, you know, the fight has not changed. We are still fighting inequities in our police departments. But our mission also includes that we stand for our community, for the black community. We will stand for any community, but primarily the black community, because we are the community that has the most issue with law enforcement. So that's what we do in a nutshell. And we do that in a variety of ways. We have a huge community service base. All of our, we have chapters all across the country, in the UK and in Canada. And we all do a lot of community service, community outreach. But we also have to take on issues. And the way we take on issues now, well, back in the day, they took on issues by filing lawsuits, which is not out of the realm of possibility now. But with social media the way that it is, we can get our message out there across the country and across the world by just going on Twitter or going on Facebook and then letting people know what's going on. And then there's that pushback from the community, like, wait a minute, you know, you can't do this to us, or you can't do this to these black officers. So by highlighting issues that we have in our police departments is the way that we mostly address issues now. And then, of course, there's some conversations that we have that maybe not privy to the public consumption to try to move along issues when we come across them.
So there was a recent problem or shooting that happened. I'm sure that you heard about this. I believe it was in the Maryland, D.C. area, where this black police officer shot someone who was supposedly handcuffed in his car, shot him 7 times. And many people have talked to me about the speed at which this officer was arrested, and they feel as if there was some type of inequity in the process. Many people have said to me, and maybe this is, you know, anecdotal, maybe we're just reading into this way too much, but they're saying that if this would have been a white officer, it would have took months for him to be, or at least days for him to be arrested. So is that the type of inequity that you're addressing, or how do you feel about that particular situation?
Well, here's the thing. Those things, it's hard to prove those things, even though we have enough anecdotal evidence to prove it, that black, and we talk about it. We know, you know, black officers will be taken to task very quickly, very quickly. No breath. They're under arrest. Where a white officer, well, let's him and haw about this for a moment and put them on, you know, suspensive pay. Yes, that does happen. However, here's what you can't justify. If the officer is wrong, it's hard to come to his defense because he really is wrong. And so I actually live in that county, Prince George's County, Maryland.
Okay.
And we are having some difficulties with how law enforcement is being viewed in Prince George's County, Maryland. For instance, there are no body worn cameras there are some officers who have them, but it's not something that is a requirement at this time. And the argument with the county executive and the police department has been, well, we don't have enough money. Well, Prince George's County is one of the richest counties in Maryland, along with Montgomery County, Maryland. And all of the county surrounding Prince George's County, especially in Virginia, Montgomery County, Maryland, you know, Washington, D.C., they have made it a priority for officers to have body-worn cameras. And we're trying to figure out, well, why doesn't Prince George's County, which is having a number of questionable shootings, issues with police officers, why is not a priority that they have body-worn cameras? That is a huge question. And yes, we are questioning that. Prince George's County Police has a lawsuit pending against a federal lawsuit that was brought about by officers of color, Latino and Black officers in the police department about racism and discrimination. So there are some systemic problems with the Prince George's County Police Department. Had that officer been wearing a body-worn camera, we might have been able to see what happened, right?
Right.
But we can't stand for him if he did something wrong. And it looks, you know, it looks pretty bad when you have shot a handcuffed man 7 times, handcuffed and strapped into your police cruiser.
Right.
We're not gonna come stand for you for that. I mean, even if, you know, we want you to get due process, and there's nothing that says that he's not getting due process. But yes, he was arrested fairly. He was charged fairly quickly. And so we do note the irony when a Black officer does something as compared to a white officer.
Gotcha. Let's talk about the importance of Black officers. Are Black officers even really necessary? I mean, from the perspective of the community, is it important for young kids in the community to see officers who look like them patrolling their streets, or is that something that really is not necessary? You know, white officers can do just as good of a job. Are we as Black officers making a big deal out of nothing?
No, I don't think we're making a big deal out of nothing. I think it's extremely important, especially that young people, well, not just young people, the entire Black community see us doing what we do, because we do it really well. And that thing is, you know, community policing has become this really, it's like a buzz phrase, but it actually should mean more than maybe it means now. It's been overly used. You know, that, you know, some people think community policing is us having coffee with a cop, but it's really not that. It's deeper than that. It's actually building relationships that build trust, and then in turn we become legitimized in the eyes of the community. So Black officers, we like the original community police officer. Back in the day when, you know, it was hard for us to be hired, and finally they hired us, they didn't put us in a car with a partner. They had us walking the beat in our own neighborhood.
Right.
And we were doing it well, and people trusted us, and people wanted to see us coming. You know, we had these relationships with the people in our community. We protected our community, and they in turn, you know, reached out to us. So we are the original community police officers, and we still are community police officers. We do it really well because, you know, that's how we were raised. It's a cultural piece. And so I think it's really necessary to have us in our communities. We don't have enough of us out there doing this thing that we do. I am in charge of the school resource officers. And there is some controversy surrounding having officers in the schools, of course. I remember when the program first came about that people were like, oh no, there's no way we want police officers in our schools. And now that we've had them in the schools for a while, they have become increasingly popular because, you know, we've got some SROs that are really good at it. And when I think of my best ones, they are officers of color. They do a good job because they have a vested interest in all the communities, in the entire school community. And they do things that are really outside of, I think, our expectation of them. And they go out of their way to make sure that the kids are safe. They make sure that they have a contact if they want to tell something that's happening in their homes that's harming them. And so, yeah, it's important that we have Black officers, and we need to have more of them, and we need to make sure that that happens.
And female officers, what is your, obviously you are a female, and so obviously the same thing would go towards them, right? Young ladies need to see older young ladies being police officers. And
Yes. And so I'm the first African-American captain. Well, I'm the only I like to say, because ain't nobody come before me. So I'm the only one that's ever been promoted in my police department. And I've seen the effect that it has had on the community. I get a lot of requests to speak on that particular issue and what my journey has been like. And, you know, I try very hard to be respectful of both my position, but also be respectful of my experience, because it was not easy to attain that rank. There were all kinds of roadblocks that I know other people did not have in attaining the rank of captain. It's important that young ladies see that there are women at the top. There are very few of us. I think in my department, I think we may have about 1,400 sworn officers. That doesn't include all the employees, but we have 3 female captains in a sworn police department of 1,400. So that's not saying a whole lot, right? That we need more than that. But women tend to be a little more measured in our response to police issues. We come with a thought process that's a little bit different from the men. So, of course, our point of view is really, really important. And let me tell you, you need people of color, and you need women at the top, at the very top ranks of the police department, because that's where policy is made. That's where important decisions are being made. You want them to have that kind of input to represent their communities. And so, yeah, just as important as officers of color are women.
And very, very good. I actually agree very much. I did an episode that was dedicated to women in law enforcement. So I appreciate your response in that. Can you talk a little bit about, are you free to talk a little bit about any type of the obstacles that you had to overcome because of your ethnicity and or your gender?
Yeah, sure. Because it's my truth.
Okay.
And my truth is that, racism is a huge roadblock for, in particular Black women. This is a caveat I need to throw in here. Black women in law enforcement are generally placed in one of two categories. We're placed in the Black category or we're placed in the women category, which I found to be convenient. We should have our own category. Black women, we're at the bottom of the food chain in terms of being in law enforcement, okay? When affirmative action, and I know that's kind of old-fashioned term, but it kind of still applies if you're looking to diversify your police department. When issues of affirmative action are raised, if a woman is promoted, they're like, oh, okay. Or Black man is promoted, they're like, okay. But if there's a qualified Black woman and she's looked over, nobody blinks an eye because, oh, well, she's in the Black category, she's in the woman category. And we did promote a woman and we did promote a Black male. And it's a convenient way to look past the Black woman.
Okay.
Speaking to other, you know, I mentor some of the sisters in our agency and have some really great relationships with a couple of them, very close relationships, and we share stories. And to a female, Black female, we have the same stories, ways that we felt like we have been overlooked, ways that we felt like we've been ignored, how, you know, things that have harmed us mentally or psychologically or emotionally in the police department. I mean, same stories, just different woman and maybe a different person who was involved on the other end. And so I have decided that, okay, yeah, we need to highlight our experiences as Black women. And I'm pretty sure that there are Black women out in the audience who are maybe in companies that are not police departments, or maybe they are, you know, in public service, or they might be in private industry and can probably mirror our stories in their industries as well, because I think this is something that's endemic in being a Black woman in America. We are marginalized. Our voices are tamped down. When we decide to speak up for ourselves, we're called aggressive, or, you know, she's not being cooperative, or, you know, she's hard to work with, or she's got a chip. You better not talk about how qualified you are, because then you have a chip on your shoulder. Those are the types of things that I have encountered in my career. And if you're not very careful, you can get you can absorb that and really think that those things are true about yourself. So you have to have a strong base, and you have to have some support. And your support might not be within the police department. It might be outside of the police department, as mine was. My mentors were men and women who did not work for my police department. Some of them were in law enforcement. Some of them are law enforcement executives, and some of them are just regular old folks and my girlfriends. It's great to have a great group of girlfriends because they're going to buoy you up. So, yeah, it has been a long and terribly stressful road. I am a 2-time breast cancer survivor. I don't like to use the word survivor. I usually use the word thriver because you got to thrive past breast cancer. You can't just survive. You got to make your life work. And so during those 2 time periods, you know, I could talk about, that's a whole nother show, talking about how that was to have breast cancer in the police department. But what I will say to you is that while I have watched my peers and other people who have had various types of cancers, people, you know, put their arms around them and, you know, make sure they had everything they want. My experience was not always like that during my breast cancer journey with the police department. But that's another story.
Well, we can talk about that another time. Yeah.
Yes. I learned what I had to learn. But saying all of that is that it was very, very hard road. I had to be very consistent and persistent in order to make captain.
Now, did you, as far as your persistence, I mean, did you get passed over for tests? I mean, you talked about when you stood up for yourself and talked about how qualified you were. You know, you got pushed back and were called angry or had a chip on your shoulder. Did you dealt with all that? Were people actually saying this to you, or did you find writing in the bathroom walls? Or, I mean, how did this come about?
most of the time it was, you know, some things when you're Black in America, you can kind of guess what's going on if you've experienced it enough. But there have been times when people actually told me, for instance, I would hear stuff like, you won't do what I say. Oh, that one right there really got me. I was like, I won't do what you say. I didn't realize, you know, and it was from someone who was a superior, but it wasn't like, okay, it wasn't from a place of, well, let me help you. So when I make these suggestions to you, this is what I need for you to try. It was more of a, do what I, and it was a Black male, by the way, do what I say. And it was like it just didn't feel right. You know, it didn't come from a place of support and respect. I've had another person who was a peer say to me, you need to put your fist down, Angela Davis.
Oh, wow.
I've been known to bring up inequities that I see, not just for myself, but things I see happening to other people. And I've been accused of calling people racist. I haven't called anyone a racist in my police department, at least not to their face. I might have thought it.
Okay.
But I never accused anybody of being a racist because I feel like people should have an opportunity to say what actually is. You know, if this isn't a race-based issue, what is it? So I've never accused anyone, you know, vocally said you are racist. I've never done that. And I've also asked a superior if I was passed over for promotion because of my outspokenness. And they told me yes.
Wow.
So, you know, it's pretty clear what's going on. I love all people. Let me know. I was raised to be loving of all, but I was also raised to not take no mess. Okay. And especially when it came to race. Okay. You don't let people just run over you because you're Black. I'm not uncomfortable around other people who are not Black or who are not women. I'm uncomfortable around everybody. I give love to everybody. But I don't believe that anyone should be treated unfairly. And so when I see it, I don't care who you are, what your race is, what your gender is. If I see it, I'm probably going to say something. if I'm in a position to do so. It just so happens I see a lot of things that affect Black officers that I feel like someone should say something about.
What is the promotional process for your agency? Is it a written test? Is it an oral board test? Is it based on merit, your arrest record? How does one get promoted in your particular agency? I'm asking that because you said you got passed over. I mean, we had a rating system or a system where it was just a ranking system. We had an oral test. We had a written test, then an oral test. And wherever you ranked on that is where you were placed. And eventually we had what we call the rule of three, where you would get passed over, but they had to pass you over for a reason, for a specific reason, i.e. some type of performance issue, or maybe you used too many sick days or something like that. So what was your process for your agency?
Pretty much the same. Once you get to the rank, well, it depends on what level. Sergeant, there is an oral assessment, but you're ranked by your score, and they have to go down the list. Once you become lieutenant, once you test to become lieutenant or captain, there's the rule of five. You talked about the rule of. So the rule of five means you can be chosen from the top five.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
If your score is tied with somebody, let's say the rule of five goes down to 85 and there's three people in who made it 85, then all three of those people are also considered. Okay.
Okay.
And I won't go into any details about that, but just to say that once you're in the rule of five, that number that you, that score, that's only 10% of what you should be. What your final assessment should be based on. So let's just say you made an 80. That's only really 8 points towards your score. The other 90% of that is your resume, your skill set, your education, and you know, all the other things that you have done.
I got you. Okay, I got you.
Yeah, so that's where the issue comes in, because my resume is really long and full. And so when it came down to it, because I considered myself passed over, because the person who was chosen, we were 1 point apart. Let's say, I don't remember what the scores were, but let's say that this person had 89, I had an 88. And it was a female, white female. And we're hurting for females, and we never had a Black female. But she was chosen. And I would have put my resume up against hers anytime. And I'm like, well, what about all these other things that I am? Did they just ignore those things?
Right, right.
And I would say yes. And that's when I went to one of my superiors who was knowledgeable and asked them, was I not chosen because of my outspokenness? And he said yes. So I did, you know, it was one of those times where I really wanted to give up. But my girlfriends were hitting me upside the head. I swear for God, if you got some girlfriends out there, ladies, and they love you, you know what I'm talking about. They were relentless. They were like, you will take this test in 2 years, because our test is 2 years apart. You will take this test. And it took a lot for me to have, you know, to put my mind around that. I went through breast cancer again, you know, that was hitting me upside the head too. And I was like, I really don't want to do this. I really just, you know, want to just step back and do something different, or, you know, not even just, I just won't even try again. I'll be okay. And, but I did take the test again. And this time I made a 98, which is kind of hard to ignore. So, I was promoted, and it's been an interesting journey since then. I'm thankful for the promotion. I think I got a lot of acknowledgement from the community. The community was very pleased, and I appreciate them too. But it's opened up a whole different way of looking at or at receiving how I am perceived by my peers and by my superiors. And I don't want to sound you know, like, it's not a big secret. It's just that another set of challenges became, you know, clear.
So obviously they're looking at you negatively, you're saying.
Well, there's some people who are clearly not pleased with it. And, you know, I'm at the point now where I'm not really concerned about that.
Right.
I'm concerned about doing the best job that I can. I feel very blessed that I am able to serve the community in the capacity that I am as Director of Community Engagement. But it is challenging to know that there are still people who just don't like you. You know, I haven't done anything to anybody, haven't said anything wrong to any of these people. I just don't like you because, you know, you're a racist. Well, how am I racist? What did I do to anybody? I haven't done anything. If I've done something, then please, you know, let me know what that is.
Is it speaking up, calling out racism, racist in and of itself, right?
If you're speaking out against racism, then you're a racist.
Right.
But, you know, we've been hearing that across the country, especially now in the, you know, with the administration being what it is in the White House. People feel like that, you know, if you speak out against what I'm doing, then you're the racist. It's just ridiculous. But I do see some of that. And, you know, hey, you know what I do? I just do my job. It's my job to do my job. And I'm going to do it the best I can. And I'm going to treat everyone the same way and equally and with respect and with dignity. So, I would be, you know, foolish to act like it's not there. It's always there. You know, people finding ways to complain about something that you did or said. And I'm like, well, so-and-so did and said that, but nobody complained about that. So, you know, it's just that, the inequities.
I got you. Just a couple more questions. You mentioned the present administration with the White House. You wrote an article or a message to William Barr, essentially an open letter kind of to William Barr, about his statements saying that those people who don't show respect towards police officers may not get their protection. He said this at a meeting with Black police chiefs back in December 2019, and then you wrote a response to that. You want to just talk a little bit about that response and why you wrote that letter?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. This man has basically given officers who are already inclined to treat a certain segment of the population differently the go ahead to do so. That's how I saw it. The people who don't like your service, if they complain, then maybe they're going to find themselves without any police service. I mean, how much more clear can you be? I felt like he sent us right on back to 1960.
Right.
We know who's complaining about police services, and well, they should. Listen, we work for the public. Okay, we don't work for ourselves. I don't know what made police officers think that we work for ourselves, but we don't. We work for the public, and when the public has issue with us, I don't care what the public looks like, what community they come from. When they have issue with us, they should let us know, and we should pay attention, even if we don't like it. So for you to say that if we're not respected, then maybe you're going to find yourself without police services. Oh, that was such a horrible, horrible thing to say. So, yeah, I did attempt to address it through my words. and, you know, just calling it for what it is, that's racism. That's racism right there.
Right.
Without you just coming right out and saying Black people, you might as well have just said Black people, because, you know, be brave. Say what you feel. And that's why I feel like we've gone back to the 60s. That is not why the police exist. Okay, the police exist to bring a protection and service to all people. And there is no requirement that we be light in order to have that happen. You know, we might be wanting to take a look at why people don't like us.
I do wish that he would
do
that.
And something about that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the answer. Why don't they like us? Why don't they?
Yeah. Why anybody wanted to, you know, take a look at that? You know, one of the best things that we ever did as law enforcement is President Obama's Committee on 21st Century Policing. One of the best things, actually sat down and took a look at, you know, where are we failing and what can we do better?
Right.
Excellent. That's what we need to be doing.
Right.
And he brought in people from all areas of law enforcement. The National Black Police Association was one of the people on that committee. I mean, we came up with these wonderful suggestions and, you know, just a short story. So at my police department, we had a committee put together and we were going to discuss these six pillars that the committee came up with to see if we are following these suggestions. It was a whole lot of work. It was a whole lot of information. And so we would meet, you know, periodically and talk about it. So one day after having several meetings, I said to the committee, listen, maybe we need to talk about why this committee was put together by President Obama in the first place. And they said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, because of race, you know, race issues with policing. Oh, my God. You would have thought I slapped somebody's mama that day. I mean, I got attacked that day. And there was only one other, during that particular meeting, there was only one other black person in the meeting. And he did not say anything. I was the one holding firm on the fact that we could not talk about those suggestions without talking about why those suggestions came about. And I think that had me take a step backwards from being promoted also that particular day, because I kept hearing it come up in the hallways that I had, you know, had the nerve to say something about race and call people racist. I never called anybody a racist. I said we need to talk about race, which makes people uncomfortable, obviously. So anyway, you know, those are the kinds of things that happen in police departments. And those are the things that I think we really need to address. And, you know, the more we address them, I think the more we can normalize those conversations.
I completely agree. Now, I want to continue to talk about our AG, Attorney General William Barr. And he actually did try to do something or try to take a step, or at least I call it a half a step in the right direction. And he announced the establishment of the Presidential Commission on Law Enforcement. And so that was something I think that Obama once again had started, but nevertheless, this administration is going through with it. And this is announced back in January of 2020. And they're going to be looking at, it had about 16 panel members, and they're going to be looking at some of the challenges of mental, challenges of law enforcement, mental illness, homelessness, substance abuse, other social factors. He's going to talk about the recruitment, hiring, and training, retention of law enforcement officers, refusals by state and local prosecutors to enforce law or prosecute crimes, the need to promote public confidence and respect for law enforcement, and the effects of technological innovations on law enforcement and criminal justice system. So he's trying to make a step in the right direction, particularly with looking at mental health, illness, homelessness, substance abuse, recruitment and retention, and public confidence and respect. So what are your thoughts about that particular commission that he is starting?
And that all sounds good, but I, you know, I fear that. if you notice, you didn't say anything about issues of inequity that, you know, the community is complaining about. All of those things, and these, and listen, before I'm going to qualify for what I'm about to say, not that police officers, somebody needs to focus on our issues too. Mental health is a big one. Health and wellness is another one.
Absolutely.
But we're focusing on us. When do we focus on the community? You know, I didn't hear anything about, why is it that the community does, why is there distrust from our community? We're not talking about that, I guess, right? Mm. We just gonna act like that doesn't exist.
Right.
We just gonna talk about us. I don't have a whole lot of hope about this commission personally. And, you know, we weren't invited as an organization. I'm not surprised about that. We're generally not invited to these conversations. Some of our peers, you know, and other organizations are, because I think they realize that those people, you know, they'll come with a different point of view. And if you don't want to hear the truth, then you ain't going to invite the truth bearers, you know, so we don't get invited. We get invited to other conversations, and that's fine. I'm hopeful, but I just don't see this solving any issues with the community. At least not right now.
Right, right. It has taken a lot of hits, and some of the hits or criticisms, I should say, are what you just mentioned, and that there's one of the biggest problems that people are having with it is that it's filled, of those 16 persons on the panel or members of the commission, I think they're all law enforcement, right? So you want to talk about mental health issues and homeless issues, you should have experts, or they should have experts from those,
absolutely,
from those backgrounds on the panel to talk mm-hmm. about it. And also mm-hmm. I agree with you 100%. You want to talk about, you know, the issues of the community, talk to whether it's Black officers, Hispanic officers, talk to Black Lives Matter, right? I know that they want to designate them as a terrorist organization, or designate them however they want, but they should at least mm-hmm. reach out and say, hey, listen, what's the problem? You know, why are you all doing this? And what is the issue and what's the problem? So I agree with you. That's why I said it's a half of a step in the right direction. We're trying to go the right mm-hmm. way, but you got to go the full way, right? Get other people besides law enforcement. Asking, you know, law enforcement officers what the problem is not going to solve the problem. So I hope that the law enforcement persons on the panel will reach out themselves and ask other experts in other disciplines their opinions.
Listen, I hate to sound like I am just, you know, but just from my experience over these last 27 years, I don't really hold out a whole lot of hope of that. I just don't. It's, you know, I've seen so many smoke and mirrors in my career with these panels and commissions and things. You know, if you don't start off by saying, you know, we're going to talk to our community, you know, what would it have been like to have the Mr. Barr say, you know, I get that people don't care for us in these communities, so why don't we just be brave and have a round table and find out what the issues are? Well, that would have gone a long way towards building trust. You cannot police a people without them trusting you, not successfully. Because what you're going to end up having is what we have now, is that the Black community in particular see the police as an occupying force coming into our communities and arresting us for whatever, you know, for whatever reason they want to. And that's what we don't want. And that's really not why we exist. So, you know, good luck with the commission. I'm going to be following closely what happens.
Well, you and I both. Thank you so much. So thank you so much for coming on. I really, really enjoyed the conversation. I don't want to hold you up too much longer. What do you have going on as far as what's going on for yourself or your commitment to LEAP and to the National Black Police Officers Association? What do you have going on in the future?
Okay, so the main thing that we have going on is we'll be in conference in Cleveland this year. Cleveland had one of our first chapters in 1972. And they fell by the wayside, you know, who knows why, but they're coming back. Cleveland has a group called the Black Shield. They're 300 or 400 strong. They are interested in coming back to the NBPA and being a member chapter. So we're going to Cleveland. Cleveland has a lot of issues with policing and the community. And so we're going there hoping we can have some conversations to solve and address those issues. Those dates are July the 15th to the 19th, with the conference itself being the 16th, 17th, and 18th, and the 15th and the 19th are travel days. So be looking for that information. It'll be on our website. You can reach our website at www.blackpolice.org. Come and visit us, join us. Registration is going to be ultra cheap. Come to Cleveland and hang out with us.
I think I may just do that. I've been dying to get to Cleveland. Seriously, I really have. I want to see that city.
Cleveland's a really nice place. If people, you know, people like Cleveland, I'm like, Cleveland is nice. You should visit Cleveland. Yes.
Yeah. I definitely think I'm going to make that happen.
Great.
All right. So thank you so much for being on Captain Hunter's podcast. I really, really enjoyed the conversation. It was very enlightening. And I hope to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
And I love that. I really would love to have you on to talk specifically about breast cancer. My wife is a breast cancer survivor. One of her good friends is a former New Haven police officer. She did 20 years in New Haven Police Department here in Connecticut, New Haven Police. And she's also a breast cancer survivor. So maybe I'll do a show on all three of you all about just law enforcement and what it's like to go through breast cancer, particularly at a young age.
That would be outstanding.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. My wife was 32 when she went through it. So, you know, so matter of fact, I will make that happen. I'll make that happen.
Okay, good.
Yeah. All right. Well, so thank you again, and look forward to talking again. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.